Today is October 13th, mm-hmm. right? And it is not the 12th of Tishrei. It's the middle of Sukkot, Chol HaMoed Sukkot, 5775. We're going to do mitzvot, Sefer Chinuch, mitzvot 419 and maybe 420. We get to it. And a little bit about Hoshana Rabbah, because I learned more stuff about Hoshana Rabbah. That's very cool.
419.
So we're starting at 419 about Torah study. I wish it was warmer. We could be in the sukkah. Maybe if it warms up by the end. Head up there. Okay, so it's a positive precept to learn the wisdom of the Torah and teach it. In other words, how we are to carry out the precepts and keep away from what God has forbidden us, and likewise to know the ordinances of the Torah in accord with the truth. About all this it is stated, and you shall teach them diligently to your children, on which our sages of blessed memory taught. Your children means your pupils. So you find that students are called sons, or maybe daughters, for it is stated, and there came forth the sons of prophets. It was further stated there, and you shall teach them diligently, meaning that the words of the Torah should be arranged in order in your mouth. When a man asks you something, do not stammer hesitantly at him, but rather answer him directly. So you should know enough to answer, right? So, but it says two things here, that we have to know what to do and what to stay away from, and that we should teach it, that we have to know it for ourselves, that we should be able to teach it, and that we should have it ready in our mouth. Those are three separate things, right, in that paragraph. So, so the concept of Torah study. So, of course, Torah study is the basis of so much. We could say it's the basis of everything, and in a way it is, because you can't do, when we say na'aseh v'nishma, you can't do na'aseh without Torah study. You can't do what you're supposed to do without knowing what there is to do. So the first aspect is to just know what there is to do, which is the female aspect of Torah study, right? Because we've talked about in the past how there's two points of Torah study. One is constant, and that's the male aspect. And the female aspect, which applies to men and to women, is to know what to do, right? So you have to study. So for women, we learn not lishma. We learn uvachein. So uvachein is to know what to do and to desire to do it. Those are the two reasons that women learn. What? Pardon? Uvachein. Uvachein. Which means, right, it's on the sheet. Right. Oh, sorry, yeah. Uvachein, which is Tzipora Heller's word. And it means and so. Uvachein means and so.
Do you think that there's some... that was something put inside of us that we just know oftentimes what to do?
As women or as people?
As women.
Yes and no. So we definitely have this understanding that we were taught the entire Torah, males and females, were taught the entire Torah in utero by an angel who was there as our special teacher. And then we have this thing that we were struck here. That's why we have this little dip here. We're struck here in the mouth right before we're born, so we'll forget it. So the question is, why learn it if we're going to forget it? And the answer is, so it will resonate as true when we learn it again, so that we'll know for sure. When we get those clicks, we know, yes, that's true. That's because we learned it in utero. That's because it's resonating with something deep inside us. It's not part of our... it's laid down as part of our subconscious, but when we learn now, it's to put it into our consciousness. That being said, it's also to drive it into our subconscious. Because that's really what Das Torah is, right? So we've talked before about Chachma, Bina, and Dat, yeah. Right? Dat or Das, like Shabbat and Shabbos. Mm-hmm. So Das is integration with the principle, total connection. So we want to learn Torah in a way that we have total integration with it. And we've used before the driving mashal, the driving parable about learning how to drive, right? Chachma is the book knowledge you can read in the book. Bina is when you see it in action sitting next to your parent before you learn how to drive, but now you see what's in the book on the street. And Dat is what we all have now. None of us remember what's in the book, but we all can live it. We all know exactly what to do, what the yellow lines mean and what the white lines mean, what the yield sign means as opposed to a stop sign. We know it. We don't even have to think about it. Not at all. It's totally integrated into how we are. Uh-huh. Our hand knows when to signal. Our brain doesn't have to think about it. Right? Like, but we are anticipating a turn and our hand just signals for us. We don't make that conscious thing to signal, right? So our hands, that's Das, when it's totally integrated into us. We think like a driver at this point. So we want that in Torah. We want Torah to be that integrated into us that we have Das Torah. The more Torah we learn, the more our Dat becomes affected by Torah. So that's what we want. And then when we have a blend of Torah with our brain, we call that Dat Torah. Dat Torah or Das Torah in the popular parlance of our
but
area.
I thought that there was a distinction. Das was more masculine learning and Bina was more feminine intuitive learning.
Yeah, so there are multiple layers in understanding these words. That is true. So when you say masculine learning and feminine learning, let's just take Aviva Bulow for, you don't know her well, but, right, very masculine learner. I mean, she had to choose, it was hard for her, as it is for almost every college student, to choose their major. Did she want biology, chemistry, physics, math, computer science? Right? All of them are DOS types of learning. They're all analytical, and they all make it, that type of learning can make it hard to do other things. She has chosen not to drive. You have to pay attention to too much. She can't swing it. She's straight A's in everything science and does research. And driving is diffuse energy.
It's too,
and it's difficult to integrate
it's
all those things.
I know several young people, and I never thought about it from that perspective in terms of how their brain worked, that have chosen not to drive or waited for a really long time, way past the age when most people drive.
Right, when kids are jumping into cars, right?
You know, I never thought about it, that it had to do with the way that the brain processes and learning techniques and, you know.
Right, so somebody who could be very dot, very analytical.
Driving's too much.
Yeah.
It
may
just
have
overloads your
right.
senses.
May have, and so it's not just driving. There may be other things.
Right.
Crowds, parties, people, you know, different things like that could be too much, but they're really great at sitting and deeply concentrating, focusing and unraveling the mystery, coding on the computer and working it again and again and again, whereas somebody else is totally on Facebook already. Like, the computer's open. Why should they sit there coding?
Yeah.
You know, like, no. So is that masculine or feminine? So we call that masculine and feminine, but we all have masculine and feminine in us, obviously. And for some, in general, it's strong. Masculine is stronger in men, and in general, feminine is stronger in women. But it's not always the case, and we both have both. So we talk about analytical type of learning as that. So that is a layer of understanding it. But another and additional and not contradictory layer is the blend with who we are. Connection, which is why we use that word when we talk about sexuality too. And he knew her, Vaida. It's the connection, that knowledge. Not just the knowledge, but it's that blended knowledge, the total integration, total connection, that deep knowledge. So it's not just getting to know you. It's being really blended with somebody. When you can finish their jokes, when you know what kind of coffee they like, when you understand them, when you can hear by the... When they call you and say hello and you know something's
they're
great, something's bad.
Right?
Mm-hmm. It's that kind of blend, right? Is dot. We want that with Hashem. Mm-hmm. We get that through learning. Thank you very much for opening for us.
We're so glad you're here. Happy Sukkot. I'll lock this one, so just let yourselves out.
Okay, great.
Here on your back.
Great, right, terrific.
So turn all the lights off.
And you can turn the lights off.
Great, thanks.
Ladies.
Thanks so much. Yeah, so it's that blend that we want, you know, so the total connection with Hashem's mind. So the same way, it's a parable, so the physical relationship with the spouse is a parable for the intellectual relationship with God. You know, so we don't have, obviously, a sexual relationship, but we want to get that level of knowledge and connection. How do we get that? We get that through learning Torah. Right, so we get that total blend. It's interesting. Today I was just learning. I love listening to Rabbi Shalom Rosner on Sefer Chinuch. He's on OU, I think, .org. OU. He's great. He speaks fast.
Do you do most of your learning online now?
I do a lot online. I mean, I use books and online. Yeah, yeah. Books online, yeah. Yeah, it's the easiest access to teachers is online, which is not Masorah. It's so important to have an in-person teacher. So that's why I also learn with Rabbi Unger and others, but make sure that I'm in person with a real teacher, that I have real questions that I can really answer. And even if I'm sitting with him every other week, for an hour and a half, but I see him in shul and I can ask a question, I can call him, I can email him, and I have access to a real teacher. It's very important to have, because for the Masorah, Masor means, we translate it as tradition, but it's not. It means the handing over. Masora is handing
the
over.
Passing.
The passing on. So you can't receive the Masora unless somebody is giving you the Masora. Mm-hmm. So you can't read it in a book or online. You can't. Right. And you can't have, it's interesting, because when I took a three-part Tela class, of which I only listened to one and a half, but from Reb Zinfegi Tursky, getting ready for the Yomim Noraim, right, getting ready for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. So she said, and she's probably 80, she said it's a different teaching modality than she's used to, and she's practicing it. I'm doing a Tela class because there's not the Masora aspect of seeing the faces of her students and how they're receiving it.
Well,
it's a vital aspect of teaching.
Conversation,
yes.
Right, versus texting.
It's like
a
right. big objection to all the communication that occurs online now.
Absolutely.
You don't have an opportunity.
Right.
To see or even to hear.
Right. It's
even
vital.
Hearing.
It's vital.
Yeah.
It's actually it's vital in the transmission process. Right. Because if you're teaching, you want to see, is somebody's face confused or lit up?
Right.
If they're lit up, take that direction. If they're confused, pause and explain. Right? You cannot see that on the phone or in a computer class.
And so, it's even hard in a video.
Very difficult
when
in a video.
Are,
even
know.
Skyping and stuff,
right.
it's better than on the phone. But it's not the same.
Right.
So it's very important to have that, both for the student as the receiver, but also for the teacher as the transmitter.
Because you have a tendency to, I hate to say, this is what happens to me when I try to learn online, I wander.
Yes.
I wander, you know.
Yes, it's very interesting, because when I did a webinar series, so they showed me the one thing that substitutes for eye contact. There's a little thingy, a little icon on the screen that shows how many of your students are on your screen or on a different screen listening.
In other words, if they're just listening.
Are they checking their emails while they're listening to your class? Or are they looking
that
at,
would have to be like
or are they looking at your PowerPoint? Yeah.
And you're like, okay, people, focus.
Right, yeah. Right. So
I've got my eye on you.
Right.
And you have to try harder to do something like this. We have to care enough to get in the car, to get out of our jammies.
Yes.
It's
actually really important. It really is, because you definitely learn in a very different way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you have the conversation, which can bring it a little bit deeper. You don't have that. I mean, I'm part of a Tela class also with a teacher in Israel, and I don't really understand it, and he doesn't really understand that a lot of the students in the class don't understand. You know, I mean, I get something out of it. I stay in the class just because I want the connection to that teacher. But it's definitely not worth an hour of my time, the amount of information that I'm getting out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really because he's not teaching it in a way that I can understand it, which means I know for a fact, I'm not saying I'm the smartest, I'm not, but in that group, I know that other people are not understanding it either. But nobody can say it.
Gee, can you please repeat that? Or does that mean?
Yeah, yeah, right. So occasionally people ask a question, but there's also a little lag still because of international phone calling and everything, so it's harder to jump in and ask a question. And then, but it's not the same, because he can't see your face to see if you really got it or not. And people are afraid to ask again. You know, and he goes a little fast, and the material is very esoteric. So, yeah. So I get a little gist, but definitely not an hour's worth of learning.
Well, I always feel very blessed that you live here and that I can come to that. I mean that sincerely.
Thanks.
Because, yeah, we're very lucky.
Thanks. Well, I'm really thankful also to be able to teach here. It's so nice. I value you as students very much. It's good for me. So, okay, let's look back now. So that's what Dator is. That's what we want to accomplish, is to be able to think in a way, to be able to think like Hashem. So, okay, so what does that mean? Of course, you know, we're not Tom Sawyer. And I remember, I still see that sometimes. You know, there's a scene that sticks out from one movie where he looks at his aunt and says, well, if an I was God, I would. And she slaps him for saying that, if an I was God. You know? So how do you have the chutzpah to say something like that?
Yeah.
So as Jews, we do. You know, that's Rabbi Kahan's, one of my favorite jokes of his. He would say, you know, what's the difference between a Jew and God? God knows everything. And the Jew knows better. So we're very chutzpahdik that way. That if we could have a conversation, we'd tell him a thing or two because we have ideas that he didn't think of, right?
Yeah.
So, right. So what, it's not to think like God, but certainly to think like the Torah, which is the will of God, which means you do want to think like God in some way. So just like we could imagine somebody that we know well, what would they say about this, even if we don't agree? You know, what would my husband say? What would my mother say? Oh, my mother in this situation would say.
Or do.
Right? We know that. Even if it wouldn't be our choice, we know enough about her to be able to predict that.
So that's sort
in
of
general.
Like internalizing.
Yes. So
it's like an internalization of...
The better you get to know Hashem, the more you could think, oh, what's this thought like? So then you want that to extend eventually to how would I drive? How would I vote? How would I shop? How would I save? How would I dress? How would I treat this person? You know, whatever it is. So you want that to be part of your thinking, integrated like how we drive. That in the end, our hand knows how to do it. Like, that's how we treat somebody. You see somebody a little yucky on the street, homeless, like a little mentally off, but you automatically smile because that is who you are. You see a human being, you see a Tzel Melokim, even if they're packaged in something less than pleasant, there a smile comes up because that's who you are. You think like God. You know, you see that in them. So that's what we want. We want to get there, mm-hmm. You know, in multiple ways. So, yeah, so that's what Torah learning... So that is one of the things Torah learning can do for us. First, it just teaches us what to do and what not to do. That's the first thing. It's just, how do we live? How are we supposed to conduct our lives physically? And then how can we get to that spiritually? Here's an interesting thing here. Let's see, on the next page. It would be right for every person of sense to take heed not to overburden the child with study while he is yet tender of limb and tender of heart. Until he grows and the strength of his heart and the energy of his limbs are increased and his bones fill with marrow. And he will be able to bear the exertion of studying without falling ill with the fainting disease on account of the great effort demanded of him. Rather, after his energy grows strong and his eyes are alight to hearken with understanding to the voice of his teacher, then it is a right, proper, and essential thing to bring his neck yeah. within the yoke of the Torah.
It's funny because when you said that, the first word that I looked
you
at,
think
I
break his neck.
I thought was break.
Right.
Yeah.
Bring his neck into the yoke of the Torah and let him not be released from it even a hair's breadth. Let him be given of its spiced wine to drink and of its honey to eat. Now, that's two separate things here.
No,
One is the yoke. Do not let him be released. But what do you get if you are in the yoke? Spiced wine to drink and honey to eat. It is delicious, but it requires bearing the yoke. I've said this before, but I'll say it again just for the visual on bearing the yoke. So from being from pioneer stock and thinking about going out to Oregon, westward ho, right? So what would be your animal of choice?
The ox.
The ox, mm-hmm. Because they're so strong and you don't have to bring their feet, right? So horses, you have to bring food with them, with you, which takes up space.
Oxen basically just
they
forage.
Eat scrub.
Forage.
Yeah, yeah, they forage. Yeah, whereas horses need the oats, which right. takes up space from what you right. could be bringing, because a covered wagon is really small.
Thought about that.
So not only are they stronger, but you don't have to bring food. You want the horse. I mean, people thought, I want a horse because when I get there, I want a horse.
Plow.
I need a plow. But really, you want an ox because they do forage and they are stronger. So think about how strong an ox is. Right. Think about how strong an ox is. Okay. So on his back, how much stuff can you put? If you're going cross country, not that much, right? You can pile his back up and he can handle whatever you could pile, but
it's not
that much.
Not a carrying device. Mm-hmm.
But what you do is if you put him in a yoke, and attach him to a wagon, he can carry a lot more.
Right.
His power is maximally utilized. So that's the same thing with the Jew. It definitely takes us away from total freedom, but our power to carry the world is much more maximized.
Yes.
Right? So when
nice.
We take it, and we can carry more when we subject ourselves to the yoke.
The yoke.
Yeah. So that's what the yoke is. It's the yoke of the kingdom of heaven. We talk about that a lot. All malchut shamayim. The yoke of the kingdom of heaven. All with an ayin. All malchut shamayim. So so that's what we're supposed to be carrying.
But, you know, it's so interesting because the neck with the Jew is stiff.
Mm-hmm.
So here's this dichotomy.
Yes,
it
is.
Having to be brought under the yoke, and yet...
Yeah, but
really
we're a stiff neck people.
We're a stiff
excellent,
neck people.
Excellent, yes. Yeah, there is that dichotomy. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, we are stiff neck people, which we need to be. I finally reconciled myself a little bit to how frustrated I was for converts to be able to convert today. It's because the bar is so high. Mm-hmm. Higher than the halacha demands. Yeah, that's what we're demanding today, is a very high bar. And I realized, what is that? And what's with the turning away people three times? Mm-hmm. You have to have a lot of chutzpah to become Jewish. Because you have to have a lot of chutzpah to stay Jewish. So
it's like trying to drain this chutzpah.
That's right. It's our test. If you don't have enough chutzpah to get
really,
in,
really
you're not going to have enough chutzpah to stay.
Really want it.
You have to really want it. You have to have enough chutzpah. We have to test and see, do you have enough chutzpah to get in? Because if you don't, you'll never make it. You'll never make it.
Once you are... Or if you're born that way, you really can't. I mean, people that say, well, I'm not Jewish anymore.
No, you can't get out of it.
I mean, you are Jewish.
Yeah,
you can't take it away.
No, you cannot. You cannot. You can.
I mean, it's inside of you.
It's absolutely inside of you. It cannot go.
And those people frustrate converts because they're like, I feel like, oh my gosh,
I can see why that would be.
Given everything.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's frustrating.
Yeah, that's why converts bring something special to the Jewish people, because we bring that energy too.
Well, and also to for an appreciation. I mean, I think people, speaking for myself only, who are born Jewish and who always have had a connection, albeit sometimes more, sometimes less, I don't think you fully appreciate the effort and energy.
It's not just effort and energy. I think you're right. There's the effort and energy that it takes to join, but I think...
Well, I mean,
I think the thing that... one of the gifts of a convert and Baal Tshuva's, what they bring is the idealism. Because the only reason why they became either Frum or Jewish is because they see the potential of what it can bring.
To
themselves and to the world. They see what Judaism is. Not just, I'm here, I'm stuck, you know, I have to do this stuff, or I'm responsible, I have to do this stuff. But rather, here's an amazing set of tools, and I want this, and I'm going to chase this. And let me show you what it looks like, right? So a lot of people born Jewish or certainly born Frum don't actually have that vision. They never saw what it could be.
The convert
right?
thinks more.
I think so.
Oh, I think
especially
that's
the dyslexic.
I think that's right. I would say that's right.
You're dyslexic. You're more into it.
It is what it is.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Majority of people also convert when they're adults, so you have a different way of thinking than when you're a child and you're...
They really thought it through.
Right. But the reason why I said dyslexic convert is because I just recently read Malcolm Gladwell's book, David and Goliath.
Mm, I love that.
He has a chapter on dyslexia.
Oh.
And he really, the main theme of that chapter is when you see things differently... You sometimes see things differently.
Oh, okay.
That it's a different way of looking at the world. Mm-hmm. So sometimes things go that way, and sometimes you see things differently than other people do.
When were you diagnosed?
I was never diagnosed because they didn't have that diagnosis when I was little.
Okay, all right.
That I have dyslexic children, I see where it comes from.
But well, you know what? My daughter sort of is dyslexic, mm-hmm. and she thinks that her kids are, and she said it really affects the way she reads.
Absolutely,
because mm-hmm. she'll look at this at the beginning of a word and just think she knows. But sort of like that bring. That's why you did it. That's because she and I just had this conversation this morning, and her kids read the same way.
100%. That's how I read. I never learned how to put the letters together, and my brain just doesn't do that.
Right. And that's how.
But I never had problems reading because I learned how to read before I started school because I memorized all the words. So any word I've memorized, no problem. I haven't. When I get to the name of a politician or the name of a new town,
it's
or the
difficult.
Then I have to like bumble through it, and I don't even retain it. You know, even if I read it, then it's like there's no space for it there. There's no space for it.
Yeah. About that. But that's
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, but it does help you see things differently because you see things differently. Mm-hmm. So I never thought about it until I read the David and Goliath, that concept of those two things being connected. Of seeing things differently.
Well, and I think that's a little bit what you were saying about a convert
sees things differently than a person who was born Jewish.
Right, but I'm just saying, especially a dyslexic one. You have the double difference.
Well, and also because especially if you came from a background where you knew quite a bit about another religion, and mm-hmm. then you came to
right. Well, then you have a whole different perspective that right. you're bringing. Right, mm-hmm. that's definitely true. Yeah, 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 for sure. Yeah, I listened to a short debate last night with Sam Harris, Ben Affleck, Bill Mayer, Nicholas Kristof, and somebody else I didn't recognize.
The one that they got into it on TV about.
Yeah,
yeah.
I just listened to that. Yeah, yeah. Because I was reading a Nicholas Kristof article, and he referred to it, so I clicked on it.
There's been a lot of buzz about it.
Yeah, yeah. It was interesting. Ben Affleck. Not a thinker.
No.
He's not a thinker.
I mean, jeez.
He didn't even think. I mean, he can't even think one sentence because they're just trying to explain a concept that he right away was stuck on you're tarring all Muslims, and they're like, no, we're discussing Islam. We're not talking about Muslims right now. We're talking about Islam right now. And he could not separate the two at all. And he's just saying, how do you tar all of Muslims? They're not that way. Look, we're not talking about Muslims. We're talking about Islam. Yeah, we're talking about a philosophy here. We're not talking about people. So, yeah,
but
he could not see the difference.
He has a large platform. Ben Affleck.
Yeah, I was wondering, what is his platform?
Well, I mean, he's very attention to him. He's a star. And the other person that really makes me nervous is the woman that George Clooney just married.
She's a human rights
attorney. Yeah,
Arma Aman, something.
But yeah, these people unfortunately, they have a lot of... people pay attention to that.
It's fascinating to me how people form opinions and all that stuff, yeah. Okay, so this is why we should learn Torah.
Right.
Because we want to be grounded in this as our opinion set. It's so important because we can be so adrift. I mean, we do worry, like, why is an actor an opinion maker? Well, because he has a platform, because we have YouTube today, because we have videos, because people can send out anything. And if you tweet and YouTube and blog, your opinions will be listened to by people.
That happened 2 weeks ago or a week and a half ago or whatever, and you just watched it, and it was... And then prior days, if something happened, it happened, and then it was done. And it couldn't be...
Right. Re-looked at and re-discussed and Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, right. Yeah, and I do. I read the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times front page and opinions almost every day, and I like the Wall Street Journal opinions, and I read the New York Times just for aggravation.
No, it's true.
Because it's important. Everybody needs a certain amount of service in their lives. You know, we sit in the sukkah. One of the reasons why we go and sit in the sukkah, besides what we talked about, the nice ideas last week, but one of the reasons is in case there is a decree that from one of the averas that we did, we need exile as a punishment. So going into the sukkah,
taste of exile.
It is. It's hopefully we could fulfill it this way. We go out of our comfortable homes, we exile ourselves to a little shack, right, and sit outside, and hopefully that can fulfill the need for exile. So hopefully also reading the New York Times can fulfill the need for service. Whatever need we have. No, it's sort of like a loose tooth. Like, it's fun when you're a kid. It's fun to play with that pain. Like, it's a pain that's... Like, what is that? Why do I like it? But I do. Okay. But we want to learn Torah, so we want to really stay grounded in what we really should be forming our opinions based upon. So... And again, if you're really grounded in Torah and not just listening, not just reading articles, and not just listening to somebody else's Torah thoughts, but actually learning Torah, so then you can be in a place where you hold strong opinions and still really respect people that hold other opinions.
Which is mostly what's missing today.
Really missing today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
mostly what's missing today. Lack of respect for a different... approach or view
right.
of what's happening.
Which so you can hold that different approach. It's interesting. Yehoshua, my son-in-law, who started his PsyD at DU and is driving there by himself.
Wow.
You've seen it. I haven't seen it yet. Have you seen him driving his car?
Him the car yet.
I haven't seen it. He has a car now that he can drive.
Oh,
it's got all kinds of controls. Anyway,
amazing.
Apparently and strangely to me, they start clinical right away. I don't think that's fair at all
to
the poor schlub that has to be a first client. Anyway, they start clinical right away. So he, I don't know the whole story, but he had either an opportunity or a requirement, something, to work in a clinic for people, transgender people, who spoke to his rabbi about it. And the driver said, it's fine. That working there and having compassion and dealing with people's issues has nothing to do with condoning or not condoning a lifestyle choice. It's fine. You work with the human being that's there. And I thought it was so nice.
It's a good approach.
Yeah,
it's a very,
yeah,
it's
right.
Lovely.
Yeah, lovely. So I just thought that was great. It's great to have a Rebbe, great to go to your Rebbe, and great to have
great
a Rebbe
to
with
get an answer.
Great to have a Rebbe with Seichel who guides you correctly
right.
and says,
which is too often
this is not
the
right.
case.
This is not about you saying it's okay
or it's not okay.
It has nothing to do with that.
Or.
Nothing to do with that. You are working with that human being right there, and it's fine.
You're struggling with something.
Oh, they so struggle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so working with that. So that's why we want to stay grounded in the Torah, because the more you learn, the better it is for you. Okay, so now on the page 259 on the bottom, there's further what the sages tell. Let's see, did we get to this? The three. Let's see. Did I put water on there? What did I have on your page?
Yeah, make water. Sure.
Water, okay. So Torah is compared to water, A, because it's the basis of all life. You can't have life without water. So we Jews are compared to fish in the water. We should be tsanua, like fish are. They swim around, they dart away. You can't really count them. We should be modest like that. But also, like a fish, we don't have shechita for fish. You know, there's no ritual slaughter for fish. They're actually considered dead, halachically, the minute you take them out of the water.
Because they need water to live.
Right. So even you don't even have to smack them in the head with a rock yet before they're considered dead halachically. Mm-hmm. So I'm not positive, but I'm pretty sure that Aver Mina Chai doesn't apply to fish. Eating the limb of a living animal, you're not permitted to do that. You have to kill an animal first. So even those people, and that is a mitzvah for Gentiles as well. They're not permitted. So that could be a problem in today's regular meat in stores, where they stun animals, and they maybe don't kill them all the way. They maybe stun them.
Before they slaughter them?
They're stunned, and then they cut, and then they might just start cutting them up, and they might die from that. Because they're stunned. I mean, did they die or not? Is the death verified or not? So for those people who are careful in the mitzvah of not eating the limb of a living animal, one would have to verify that that animal has been fully killed before it's cut. Before it's cut apart. Otherwise, those cuts are aver mina chai, and they're usur for everyone on the planet to consume. So, but I'm pretty sure that a fish doesn't have that. So we are compared to fish, we Jews are compared to fish, because take us out of water, we're dead. Take us out of Torah, we're dead. There's no life in the Jew without Torah. Also, though, water has no shape, and it takes the shape of whatever vessel it's poured into, which is why all the emphasis on midot, on midos, character traits, because that is the shape of the person. Mida actually being measurement means measurement. Mida means a character trait, but it also means a measurement. So the measurement of a person is their character traits. So that's the shape that they are. When you pour Torah into a certain container, it takes the shape of that container. So if you have good midot, it's beautiful when it's poured into you. And if you have bad midot, it's not so beautiful when it's poured into you. So
it made me think, I saw this food thing the other day where these people were taking the skeletons of the fish and frying them and then eating them, the actual skeletons. And I was thinking
bones,
to myself,
the bones?
Yes.
What is that?
Is it kosher?
Yeah.
You can eat
if it's kosher
fish.
Yeah, you can.
It was the weirdest thing. It was somewhere in China or something.
Used to be when they made gefilte fish, they ground up all the bones and everything in it.
Yes, I remember that.
Remember that? It's
from Israel days.
Yeah,
when
really,
there were eyeballs and scales
and
bones
fish,
and fleth.
The
Israeli gefilte fish was nasty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it had all kinds of...
Yeah.
It was
because
awful.
Got lots of chopped up bones.
And scales and stuff.
Really
it was gross, yeah.
I never thought about the scales.
Yeah, no, the American stuff is delicious. Now, Israeli gefilte fish is now good.
Now it's fine.
We're talking back in the day.
That's just how they made it.
I think it's not just how they made it. I think it's how poor people make food.
Well, sure. You have to eat as much as possible.
Yeah, you have to eat as much. You're not going to be wasting things. Look how we waste so much nutrition from our food and food, but so much nutrition because it's not our taste. We'd rather not eat the skin. We'd rather
not eat the bones. But
yeah.
Probably actually they were very good for you because they must have had some ingredients that were probably healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. I noticed now they sell the bones of a chicken and they sell the...
Yeah, so you can put it in your soup. Yeah, because they want to get as much money as they can out of it.
For soup?
Yeah.
Use it for soup rather than buy the whole thing?
You can get chicken.
Really?
It used to be in the old Mondays. Yeah. You could get the whole chicken.
Right, with the feet on it.
Yeah.
Dukes always talk about his mother
eating the feet. Yeah.
Called feasts.
Yep.
Yeah, no, that's, Duke always talks about it too with his mother, yeah.
Nasty
they used
little
to eat
feet.
The feet,
oh, yeah.
Suck the bones.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. Yeah. Yep, I got served that once. That was in a Persian house in Israel, and they were a poor family. You know, the father's job was, he had a little stand on Rehov Yafo, and he sold sunglasses and safety pins. That was his whole job. And then we would close that stand at night and lock it, and he'd sit there all day. And so that was the parnassa of the family. And the mother worked in that as a what's that called? You know, where you serve food on a lunch line.
Cafeteria.
Thank you. So this family, she was one of the girls in the army with me, and I was there for Shabbos, and I don't think they ever saw a white girl before. It was like I was such a strange creature, you know, to these Persians who had walked from Iran to Israel. The parents actually walked there, and then they had their family there, and it was like a two-bedroom apartment. The parents had a room, and the boys had a room, and the girls slept on the floor on the carpet, in the living room. Yeah. So, that's how the family lived. Anyway, so they had chicken for Shabbos, and I was their Shabbos guest, and so I was served first before the father.
You got the best part.
Wow. And I got the feet.
Which was the best part?
The best part. The best.
Well, the first,
two little feet in the bowl, just looking at me with their little toenails.
And that's really tough.
Wow.
But you know what? It's interesting.
I said, thank you. I said, sure. Clearly it was such a coveted...
Yeah.
I said, I'm sure there's somebody who would enjoy this a lot more than me. I'm totally like willing to forego and give it to the person who would really enjoy it. Yeah. But she still remembers it too. She's like, remember when we gave you the feet? I'm like, oh, I remember. I totally remember.
But it used to be in Israel, all the people who did all the menial labor were from... Mm-hmm. Arab countries.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember the first few times.
Particularly
I was
Morocco.
There.
Yeah.
It bothered my parents a lot.
Yes. Well, so when I was in the army, and one of the insults for being stupid was, and I did not know what this meant. I had to ask somebody, they said, Mata Moroccai. I didn't know that it was Moroccan at first. I just thought that meant imbecile. Mm-hmm. What are you, a Moroccai? I said, what does Moroccai mean? And they said, me Morocco. I'm like, it was, so that's what people, because that was those are the laborers or the Moroccans. Yeah. Yeah. So that was the underclass back in the day. Yeah. So that's changed now. Different underclasses, but hopefully they'll all move up and be integrated into the whole. Okay, so I just want to point out here also, we have this concept today, and I think we're seeing it with ISIS also. Lo rav lalecha velo tzama lamayim ki im lishmoa et divrei Hashem. People will not be hungry for bread or thirsty for water, but rather thirsty to hear the word of God. So you're thirsty for Torah. So it's also compared to water because you're thirsty for it. People are thirsty for it. But we're seeing people today who are coming from affluent homes, so it's not about underclass, and people come from families that are strong, so it's not about misery. It's about they want meaning in their lives. That's who's joining ISIS right now, is people who are looking for meaning.
Well, that's how they appeal to them. They say, look at how, you know,
look how vapid Western society,
dissolute the West is, how focused they are on money.
On nothing,
you know, just regular things.
Come find meaning with us. Mm-hmm. And so people are joining, people from families with money and families that are intact, and yeah. So we have to know.
Take that stuff off of YouTube and...
Oh my gosh, yep. Okay, so this is a mitzvah that applies to everyone in every place except for women. Because it is a positive time-bound commandment. But let's read this paragraph. It is a precept, so on page 261. The precept is enforced everywhere, every time for men, but not for women, since your sons is stated. And our sages of blessed memory interpreted, but not your daughters. So too, a woman has no obligation to teach her son, for whoever is not under the obligation to learn is not under the obligation to teach. 261. Yet in every case, it is right for every woman to endeavor that her sons should not be ignoramuses, even though she is not so commanded by the law of the Torah. And good reward will be hers for the effort. So too, here's interesting. So too, if a woman studied Torah, there is reward for her. Nevertheless, nevertheless, the sages ordained that a man should not teach his daughter Torah, for women are light-minded, and they will apply the words of Torah to matters of nonsense in their paucity of understanding.
Boo.
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 Right.
Boo.
So, right. So, on one hand, boo, and on the other hand, you see it. You see people who are stupid. There's people, I mean, I think we're a select few. That's the truth. We are a select few. There's plenty of people who learn stuff and are idiots with it. Whether they read an article in the New York Times.
But it has nothing to do with them being women.
No, but it doesn't. It
men
does not.
Or women.
Yes, they can
do
both be
the same thing, and we see a lot of evidence in it.
We do see a lot of evidence. We do.
I mean, just in our people.
Yes, we do.
So it's sort of, it is not really.
It is not about being female. Nevertheless, at that time, it was more about being female because they were less exercised as a whole in education, as a group.
Well, in general.
Historically,
right.
They were.
Women were
really
always taught to read and write.
But in general, in the Jewish community, women had a much higher literacy rate than everybody else.
Right, but it was still very low.
It was still low. It was still low.
Do you, I have to ask a question, because it wouldn't pertain to you, but like, let's just say, like, everyone else's holidays. Do you really discuss a lot of Torah, like, for instance, when you're at Break the Fast? Because I kind of tried to bring some things up and break the fast. And the conversation only because I was trying to move it away from Botox. And that's
right.
What the entire conversation was about and was driving me crazy.
Good for you.
But
it's a super challenge. It is a super challenge. Okay. Some people do. Some families do. We're not one of those families. We definitely have a roller coaster conversation in our house that goes high and low, and both. Yeah, definitely.
But it must integrate Torah. I can't.
Yeah, I try, but you know, but it really depends. I find it fascinating. There is almost a magnetic repulsion for certain members of our wider circle. So as soon as Torah starts being discussed, they're out of there.
The subject, or
they either change the subject or they leave the table.
Oh.
Yeah,
oh.
Just out of there.
Because they're just not into talking about
Mm-mm.
it. Or...
Mm-mm. So it's fascinating to see what happens, just to watch, you know, and it's fascinating to look at other people's houses. We went to the Cher's house for Friday night, and it was so nice to see their son. It's so interesting to see how a multi-generational family, for Hares, their child, tests them, but it's part of the play and pleasure in child rearing and in parenting and in grandparenting. So whether it's in Torah or in other things. So this child happens to be a smart child. I think they have, maybe he's 7 or 8, you know how old he is?
Well, that
fifth
would
grade
be 10. In fifth grade, that would be 10 or 11.
10. So he knows stuff about history, and my husband's a history buff. Right, so he just gave him a little, you know, but he little tests and like, you know, and so that's why we call that a Sherman. He says, yes. So the kid says, it's named after General Sherman, huh? Right? So then my husband can say another thing and see, where are you holding? And like little pings there. We do that in Torah too. I saw that at a Shiva call that I paid for Lucy Prenslau, but her brother was there and one of the grandchildren came. So that's two generations down. And he didn't really know this grandchild, but they know their relatives and they're connected. What can you talk about? Right away, Torah. What mission are you learning? Right? Oh, sukkahs. How high can a sukkah be? How, you know, what can you use for schach? He knows right away there's a conversation and he can test him in it. And this little kid can show off his knowledge and the great-grandfather aged person can, you know, he knows
in
how to...
Fallen.
Yeah, yeah. So it's fascinating to see that the conversation and how it works and the testing and how it works.
About sukkahs. It's 40 cubits, I think.
40 cubits is the tallest.
Yes.
Right, that it could be. And 10 tfachim, I think, is the lowest it could be, because you don't even have to be able to stand in the sukkah.
And it can be in a wagon.
Yes, it can be in a wagon. That's why Chabad, good for you. That's why Chabad has a sukkah mobile.
We did this.
Yeah.
We had this whole, I don't know, somebody in one of the congregations, it was like 10 or 15 little
uh-huh.
rituals, and then we had the rules.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
But I retained
great.
At least a little.
Great. Anyway, but we do see clearly here that if a woman studies Torah, there's reward for her, so keep studying, even if it's not going to be our fathers who teach us, for whatever reason. And that may be, if we want to make a diuk on that, a diuk is a separation of the two. Dikduk is grammar. Diuk is related to that, so that means a hair split on it. So we can see the diuk, that's not just that women shouldn't learn, but here, listen to the sentences carefully. So too, if a woman studied Torah, there is reward for her. Nevertheless, her father shouldn't teach it to her because she's light-minded, but maybe not the one who acquires it on her own. Maybe she's not. It's good for that one. That one who seeks it, there's reward for her. That one who has to have it poured on top of her, maybe it's not such a good idea. Today we do teach girls Torah, and it's interesting, you know, there is an aim to marry the daughter of a Talmud Chacham. You want to marry a daughter of a Talmud Chacham. Why? Because she knows Torah. She's not going to mix you up in your house, right? She knows how to keep a kitchen. She knows how to dress. She knows how to speak. She knows the holidays. She knows how it works. So you want a daughter of a Talmud Chacham. Today, a girl who went to a Beis Yaakov or a similar type of a school has the din of a daughter of a Talmud Chacham, even if her father's not Ma'aretz. She has it because she's learned. So the question is, you want somebody who's learned, who's been acculturated and is learned enough to run a home that's permeated with Torah, that you understand how it works. So a properly educated girl is also considered the daughter. There's different ways to get that education, let's just say that. You could absorb it from your parents' home, or you could get it out of a school, too. So there's different ways. Okay, so I guess we're not going to do Shema today, but I do definitely want to do a little bit of Hoshana Rabbah. Just a little bit. Has anybody ever seen this book?
No.
I've had it on my shelf for a long time. This is Rabbi Eli Monk's World of Prayer, commentary and translation of the Siddur. So I bought it because it's a classic written in the 30s, and people refer to it a lot in different things, that it's a classic, modern classic, kind of like Rav Dessler, modern classic, something that really people refer to a lot, this commentary a lot. And this is the second volume. I've had it on my shelf just because of that, and I haven't really opened it. But I thought, you know what, Sukkot, I want to learn some more Torah. I opened it up about Sukkot just to see, like, what are some of the tefillot on Sukkot. So it does not actually go much into the tefillot of Sukkot. I mean, it's not a sentence-by-sentence commentary, which is what I expected. It has more information about it and why we daven that way. So it has a whole chapter on Hoshana Rabbah, which is very interesting, because in Book of Our Heritage, which is my go-to book for holidays and stuff, it's like Mary Poppins, you know, carpet bag, it's always something in there. So in Book of Our Heritage, when it talks about the custom of beating a ravot, right, so on Hoshana Rabbah, the seventh day of Sukkot, the final day of Sukkot, because Shmini Atzeret is a new holiday, right? So on Hoshana Rabbah, we take the aravot and we beat them on the floor.
Wave it.
Uh-huh. Wave it, yeah. Or beat it. So there's two different customs. One is waving and one is beating, okay? So in Book of Our Heritage, it talks about the custom and it says, the kavanot are very deep and mystical, and it's too much to really understand. Just have in mind that I'm doing whatever I should be doing for any of that stuff to be properly triggered. That's it. Right? Here, he discusses it more. So it's really interesting. I found it really interesting. He really goes into it. So if you want more...
In layman's terms, though.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend reading it. I mean, it's worthwhile to look up all the sources, which I did not do, but it's an interesting learning. He has lots of information about it. So first he talks about just the name Hoshana Rabbah, and that's a relatively new name. It's from the Middle Ages. Before that, there's lots of other names. So we call it Hoshana Rabbah because there are times when we say Hoshiana, save us, right? So Hoshana, we say that while we're making a procession with the lulav around the, well, it's really around in the temple. Now we just do it in the synagogue around the bima. We do a procession every day. We do seven processions on Hoshana Rabbah. So it's the most Hoshanas. Rabbah is a lot. So it's Hoshana Rabbah. There's lots of Hoshanas on that seventh day. In temple times, we did separate, where lots of offerings were given to the separate, all the nations. He discusses that too. He says, why do we give? We have 70 bull offerings for the 70 nations on the days of Sukkot. The nations don't even know what they lost, he talks about. So they would be crying if they would understand what we were doing for them in the Beit HaMikdash. They could cry over the loss of the Beit HaMikdash too, because we're not doing that for them. When do we do that? We do it only after Yom Kippur. Only after our slate has been wiped clean and we're in good standing with God can we then pray on behalf of others, really, who maybe aren't in such good standing. Because now we're the good kid in the class, right? Or the good kid in the family for a few days.
For now.
And so we say, as the good kid, could you be nice to my neighbor too? So that's what we're saying. That's why we bring those offerings. We say, there's other nations and we want to pray on their behalf. Things should be good for them also. So each one of the days, mystically, is compared to the seven millennia of Jewish history. So Hoshana Rabbah to the seventh, right? So to the great saving that should be in the seventh. We're in the sixth still, 5775, yeah. Right? But we're coming up on the seventh. So he talks about the different mystical things that are happening. So one of the things that happens, which is fascinating, so we talked about last week how the four species represent four different types of Jews. And the willow branch represents the one with no taste and no smell, right? So the Jew that's not really pulling his weight, that doesn't really know, that's really kind of a drag on the people of Israel, what do? A little beating. We want to say, we're not forsaking you, but you have to come back into the tribe. Yeah. Like, we got to get you back. Focus, focus. So that's what we are saying at the end. Like, we're not cutting you off. We're not taking those Hoshana, the Aravot, and throwing them out and saying no. But we are saying, actually, there's a little work that needs to be done here. Let's go.
It's just with the willow. It's not with just the entire...
With the willow. No, just okay. With the willow.
Okay.
Some people add extra willow to it, so they're not taking it out. Another branch, yeah, another thing, another bundle of willow. It also has to do with the water, because we're judged for water on Sukkot. And Hoshana Rabbah is the final day of Sukkot, so it's the end of that judgment. So the willow branch is the water grower branch, right? It grows by the edges of the water. So they would put willow branches all around the Mizbeach in the temple, in the Holy Temple, just to signify extra water and to invoke the blessing of God on water and on that which grows from water, which is everything, including our Torah learning, right? Everything grows from water. So we want that extra blessing. So the willow has to do with that too. But so we have a few different symbolisms in it. There's multiple symbolisms in what we're doing.
Well, the water.
There's also the drawing of the water, right? So you draw the water at that time during Sukkot. So it's a whole water thing because water is judged at that time. So also, one of the reasons why water is judged at this time is because the time of tithing is now coming to a close. So how did you tithe? Did you do your animals right? Did you do your money right? Did you do your crops right? So it's a time for all of us to think this week, did I pay my pledges? Yizkor, Yom Kippur, tithing, whatever you pledge to tzedakah, make sure you pay it because we're being judged. Based on how well we paid our tithes, right? How well we participated in the system. So until we finish, this is a chance to finish it out. So there's a lot more karbanot brought during Sukkot because people are finishing up their payments. But I, as I was preparing for this class, made sure to write my check and address it. I forgot to put it in the mailbox as I was walking out the door, I just realized. But I wrote it, addressed it, and stamped it. I'm Yom Kippur pledge. So that would be paid. So just think about that today. Make sure you pay whatever pledges you have because we want to make sure we do our tithes and pledges because we're being judged. So water also equals parnasa, right? So our money is being the finishing of the judgment of our money and water and all the flow of things is coming. So we want to make sure that we take care of ours so Hashem can take care of his because Hashem is our shadow. He behaves like us. So we want to be sure we behave well. Anything else on Hoshana Rabbah for now? It's a festive day, so dress pretty, eat nicely. See, people make a meal, a festive meal for it, but it's not fully festive because he does discuss the prayers. We use the same tunes as a full festival day in the davening, but we don't say the full festive. We don't say nishmat because we don't get an extra neshama that day. And we do say Mizmor LaTodah, which is something we don't say on Sabbaths and festivals. But so it has a mixed quality of a day. So all of Chol HaMoed, which we're in right now, is Yantif-ish. Hoshana Rabbah, a little more. So, right.
A little more what?
A little more Yantif. It's a little more, between. On the continuum.
It's the air of Yantif.
Yes, it is. But you might want to just sit down in the morning for breakfast, wash, and bench. Right? Wear something pretty. And wear something pretty while you cook.
Oh,
yes. We have a custom to dress up more for doing
filming. To the
I don't. I personally do not. Mm-hmm. I have in Israel. I might if I was in a neighborhood.
These
yeah, I do it in the sukkah. I do it in my sukkah. I do it by myself in the sukkah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, just be denied. And I have in mind what he said. Maybe I'll learn again, but I just have in mind, Hashem, please take this action, whatever it's supposed to be. You know what the kavanah should be. Please make those kavanahs real. Make sure that happens. Yeah. I'm just doing what I'm supposed to do.
So when do you actually do that?
In the morning of Hoshana Rabbah. So I shake the lulav. If I get extra aravot, nice. If not, then after I do the lulav, then I take the aravot out of the lulav.
Right? Mm-hmm. Wednesday or
Wednesday? Yeah, it's Wednesday.
It's Wednesday.
Okay. Wednesday is Hoshana Rabbah. Yeah. Okay.
All right. Yeah. So now, next week.